Poetry on the Radio. Poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the second of two installments in conversation with Canberra-based poet K.A. Nelson. Plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. For ArtSound FM, I'm Peter Searles. K.A. Nelson grew up in Mudgee, left school at 15, learned secretarial skills, and travelled for a decade. Then she studied teaching, English literature and drama, and moved to the outback. Over the years, she has lived and worked in New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, Italy, the Northern Territory, and Canberra. After working for 3 decades in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs, she returned to studies at the University of Canberra to write a memoir with poetry as part of a master's degree by research. She has garnered poetry honours and praise for her writing, which often evokes her life in inland Australia. Her Inlandia, from Recent Work Press in 2018, was runner-up for the ACT Writers' Centre Book Awards for Poetry in 2019. In Meaty Bones, also from Recent Work Press in 2023, she expresses her concerns about the natural world and various aspects of contemporary Australian society. She often collaborates with visual artists, as we'll hear today. At the end of last week's program, K.A. Nelson was telling us about her childhood in Mudgee, New South Wales. Kimberly K. Williams asked Kerry Nelson about her poetry about her childhood.
Your father was a barber?
Yeah.
And you've got a poem called Behind the Counter, which is a completely different, depicts a completely different space and time than many of these other poems, right? This takes us back and it's a very particular place, again, with very particular things.
I'm really glad you chose this poem because this is one of my favourite poems. I love this poem because it is so me and so him. Anyway, Behind the Counter. Behind the counter in my father's barbershop, I sold cigarettes and matches, pouches of tobacco, tally-ho, took money for haircuts and gave out the proper change. After every customer, I swept up, watched my father hone a blade on leather, make small talk with a farmer, brush hairy residue off thick red necks. I restacked pipes in sweeping arcs, displayed Brill Cream to advantage, answered the black telephone. Did I want to be the woman blowing smoke rings in that poster on the wall? In lieu of wages, I stole cigarettes and chewing gum. My favourite brands were Juicy Fruit and Marlboro. Sometimes I dressed the window. As I wound crepe paper round a cardboard cylinder to make a barber's pole, I made a vow. I would never work behind a counter, cut anybody's hair except my own.
Peter Monaghan observed.
The title poem of Meaty Bones is related to that poem, and it relates something of your background and your father's work. It also speaks to that difficulty of changing one's own cultural formation because it's addictive when you smoke.
Meaty Bones. One of my father's professions, tobacconist. He packed the shelves of his barbershop with every brand of cigarette, tobacco, pipes, lighters, smoked Benson and Hedges. He moved my copy of a book on big tobacco from the counter to a drawer beneath the cash register. Mum, open to data and arguments, quit, but it took a cardiologist to convince Dad to stop smoking. It was just one more bone of contention we liked to chew. And oh, how we loved those meaty bones.
I love the mention of Benson and Hedges in this poem, Marble, and the other one. Juicy Fruit, the gum, right? My grandfather chewed a half a stick of Juicy Fruit at a time. That was his great pleasure.
You know, in this country, they weren't sticks. They were little pellets, weren't they?
Yeah.
And they always came in a four-pack, four pellets, just a little pack like that.
Yeah. They were very easy to steal. And I thought my father should have paid me to work in the barbershop. But you know, my eldest brother and I both did a stint in the barbershop, and he left. He left when he asked Dad about giving out some change to one of the customers. And my dad, you know, sort of gave him a bit of stick for even interrupting his customer. And so my brother never worked there again. He just, you know, refused to go back. But I did quite a long stint in the barber shop.
It's really delightful how you have such different poems fill these spaces. It takes us as readers to a lot of places, but then, you know, it shows a very rich life, a very rich tapestry.
Very long life.
I noticed both of the books are broken into sections.
Yeah.
And there's a section, so one about rivers. And I'm partial to rivers. I adore a river.
Me too.
Even more so than the ocean. And so I love that this whole section begins with the poem Water Stories. And then a very long poem that's in many parts.
Yes.
Many parts. And yes. It covers, starts in 1958, and it goes right through to 2022, top end, at the end.
The genesis for this sequence was when I was working up at Mataranka, and we were on the banks of the Roper River, and there were crocodiles everywhere. It was the first time I'd been up there since a long time ago, but I was at work and with a lot of traditional custodians, and they were all fishing very nonchalantly, and I was very wary of being on the bank of the river, and I just that discomfort of being there, knowing that they were very, very comfortable, took me back to a time when I was very comfortable by a river. And so I started to think, okay, I think I wrote the one about the Roper River 2021,
yeah,
number 12. I wrote that first, but then that sparked the need in me to think about the very first memory I had of being by a river, which was number one in 1958. Oh, and so then I start to think, oh, well, you know, I am a, you know, I've done this whole thing on being inlandia. Let me do this whole thing on rivers. Stockyard Creek, 1958. A grassy bank, string knotted around a chunk of meat, dangled. Me and Auntie Marg haul in half a bucket of yabbies. We cook and eat. Bellies full, we lie on a grassy bank. Look up. Interpret shapes in clouds. There's a rabbit, says Little Eye. Auntie replies, we'll have to trap it.
I laughed out loud when I hit that line.
The last one, number 14, I've played around with the font for this. So the first line is very faint and very small. It's called Top End 2022. Big rain. Big plan for cotton. Bigger water allocations for big white men. Big mistake.
And the last, the big mistake is the darkest and the biggest font.
Exactly.
Yes.
Next year is the anniversary of independence in Papua New Guinea. And this was one of my first experiences. And I'm thinking of doing a celebration of what PNG meant to me. This sort of gives a little bit of an indication of what I got up to in Papua New Guinea. It's called number 4, and it's called Kemp Welch River, PNG, 1974. The chaplain's wife and I lead an excursion. Duke of Edinburgh Award, bronze and silver medals. Students, teenage village girls, show us how to make a raft, travel on crocodile-infested water. We show them how to make doughboys on a stick filled with golden syrup. Very unequal exchange.
But just the juxtaposition, right?
Yeah.
You just let it speak for itself. And then would you read the 12th one?
Yes, this was the first one, the one that was instrumental in the whole sequence. Number 12, Roper River, 2021. On a riverbank with a sheer 2-metre drop, I sit with knowing women. Pandanus and weeping paper bark branches dip their leaves where turtles feed unseen. I'm nervous. Crocodiles. Salties. Unlikely to climb this embankment, but if they do, will I have time to roll to one side, run between the blackened trunks of the fan palms to the unlocked four-wheel drive? Any calm is troubled by my conscience. I have colonised Janie's ground sheet, her fishing spot. She's moved downriver, leaving me dangling a worried line. I catch nothing except my wan reflection. Janie catches three turtles. Too shy to ask, embarrassed by my earlier faux pas, I hang back. If the cooked flesh is offered, I will taste it. Janie teaches her daughter how to prise the flesh from the shell with a blunt knife. Observe the protocols. Janie eats the liver, the sweetest delicacy. It is, after all, her catch. Sam tells me turtle flesh tastes like chicken. Still making mistakes in 2021, Peter.
That fear that you have naturally of crocodiles, it's natural and it's probably wise to be vigilant around animals that can, you know,
Eat you.
Or worse than that, drag you under and chew you before they eat you.
And now that there's so many of them.
So, in a way, that poem seems somewhat emblematic of your life, where you have to approach it with some sort of trepidation, but you go ahead and do it anyway. Everybody's acculturated and to some degree then fearful, and you imagine things that perhaps aren't there to be fearful of even.
I've got a friend who was in Papua New Guinea with me, and we've been writing to each other since 1976, and she just thinks I'm very bold.
But she would have, I mean, if you've known her that long, she would see the pattern. True?
Probably.
But what we're sold is the notion that to go to Papua New Guinea at all is foolhardy.
That's right.
I mean, this is like a typical story of that sort of bad acculturation or limiting acculturation, that perhaps you're one of these people. Everybody I know who's ever lived in Papua New Guinea speaks so highly of it as almost idyllic, and yet that's so far at the opposite end of what we're constantly told.
I'm still in touch with a woman who was one of my students. She was 13 the year that I taught domestic science to a group of seven girls that didn't have a teacher. And she's now, she came down and did a PhD at Wollongong and is working very high up in health in Enga province. And we're still in touch, and still she lives in a very lovely village situation on her own land. And all you hear, and I'm sure that these things are true, when elections take place and, you know, there's big tribal fights and they steal the ballot boxes and all sorts of things happen. And I'm sure it's maybe worse than when I was there, but when I used to travel out of the Enga province, the tribal fights would, you know, you'd come across a big group and they would stop and they would separate off the road. You'd drive through and then they would start the fighting again. And, you know, there's a whole pattern to it that we just don't get. But I've been rereading Meggett and other anthropologists that have written about PNG in those days, and there is a pattern to the whole thing that's very, very interesting. They know what they're doing.
You have a poem about that moment in your life where you were asked to teach these seven girls.
Oh, yes. That's in the sequence of the river. Yes, this is in the Enga province, which is right over on the Irian-Jaya border. It's the last one in the middle of the country. It's number 5, Lagite River, PNG, 1976. They cross the river twice a week, 6 girls, grade 7 students, to cook and sew with me. There is no female teacher. The headmaster shows me how to write a lesson plan, hands me the curriculum. The pay is local, the equivalent of $30 a fortnight. We locate 3 treadle sewing machines, set them up in my spare bedroom, buy bobbins, cottons, one Primus, then another. On market days, the girls and I work out a budget, buy local produce with a small allowance from the Board of Governors. Returning home, we cook a meal using Primus's and my wood stove. On the front veranda, we eat what we have cooked, watch men from the Calaboose do time, hoe river flats, plant local crops for market, potatoes expatriates will buy at the nearby Samu trade store. At year's end, students get a proper teacher. I head south to Teachers College.
It's a really lovely narrative poem, where you really do lay out in just five prose stanzas this whole year you had, right? And I think the ending is the beginning also for you.
Yeah. So. Yes, I thought it was very ironic. I hated home science when I was at school, could not sew to save myself, and same. Here I found myself teaching it. We had a lovely time.
Sounds like it, especially if you're still in touch with one of the
girls.
Yeah,
that girl's, yes, she's a lovely young woman. Mm. And last year her daughter came down and did she's in the Papua New Guinea Defence Force. And so Betty wrote to me and said, my daughter's at the out at the Defence Force. Would you keep an eye on her? So I had a round for roast pork and baked potatoes. And went to her graduation and had a lovely time with her daughter, who is a very modern young woman living in Papua New Guinea. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned another relationship with the painter, Kate Waite, your friend. And because I noticed that you've written a few poems, at least in Inlandia, that responded to her work. Is she somebody that you met when you were living in the Northern Territory? And have you collaborated at all more with her? What parallels do you see between her work and yours?
I met Kate when I moved. Actually, I met her when I was still in Tennant Creek. She drove through with a friend of mine and stayed at my house for lunch. And then when I moved to Alice Springs, she was out at Santa Teresa. She was running Keringer Arts. She was a coordinator there. And I was working for the Northern Territory Open College, and we were funding little art projects all over the centre. And hers was one of them. And so I used to drive out to Santa Teresa and see how the project was going and meeting the artists. And she would come to town and stay at my house. And, you know, you just became very good friends like that as part of life, really. And so we've known each other since 1989 really well. And when she invited me down to South Australia, well, we did two workshops down there out in the Flinders Ranges, where she got a whole lot of artists to go to a camp, and I was the sole poet. But I did art at school, so I sat in the riverbank with the artists and did art. And at night, I gave them little workshops in poetry. And on the last night, I told them about sestinas and showed them how to do a sestina and got everybody to contribute, and then came up with a sestina about the workshop.
Wow.
It was really good. I can teach sestinas, but I can't write them myself. No, not good ones anyway.
I was about to ask, how is it easier or harder with a group of people than it is with one? Because it's hard enough with one person.
I found it easier with all of them contributing. But I can't, I have never been able to, crack the sestina myself. But Kate and I are still in touch. She's moved from South Australia to another town that's too far away to visit. And so we don't collaborate anymore. But she did come up and have an art exhibition at M16. And I used the Culture Shock poem as a way to introduce her artwork in that exhibition, read it at the opening, and she did a portrait of me later on, which I don't like very much, but you know.
Where can we see that? Was it?
It's in my holding room under the car park.
Hidden away.
Hidden away.
Okay.
I look a lot like my mum, and one day I'll get it out when it looks like me perfectly.
Would you maybe read one of the poems that you wrote in response to one of her works?
Sure. This one got published somewhere else anyway. So this is called This Is a Woman, and it's in response to Kate Waite's painting of Mrs. Abbott, done in 2006. It's a wonderful painting. And although it talks about, it riffs off that painting of Mrs. Abbott, it also refers to many senior Aboriginal women that I've met over the years. This is a woman. In the early hours of these bitter mornings, when the fog comes down and settles, when the only cars on Commonwealth Avenue are taxis changing shifts or ministerial staff cars taking lackeys home, when flags hang slack in the dark, stiffen in the cold on their steel poles, my thoughts fly north to the desert, to a woman who calls me daughter, who took me to dinner camp, told me a story, taught me a song, showed me a dance. This is a woman who travels the land where stories are danced and country is sung, where magic and myth is retold in the sand, where kinship and totems are like lines on a hand. This is a woman who travels with women, whose customs and life move in time with the moon, whose birth on a songline means obligation, whose night sky is peopled with ancestral kin. This is a woman who travels with crows, who glides across country as hunter and healer, who teaches clans women all that she knows, who carries the law wherever she goes. This is a woman who travels around on everywhere roads crisscrossing the land, knows bitumen highways lead to trouble in town, gridlock the cities, spoil old hunting grounds. In the early hours, my thoughts fly north to the desert, to a woman I call mother, who took me to dinner camp, told me a story, taught me a song, showed me a dance. She is a woman, our elder and leader. She is a woman who travels the land. She is a woman who longs for old times. She is a woman, the last of her kind.
Kerry, in these books you mention a variety of kinds of interactions that there have been between, I guess, European Australia and First Nations Australia. Do you come away from all this, and as you write about it, do you come away with a sense of optimism despite, for example, what happened with The Voice?
I do a lot of work with Kim Mahood, who's quite a well-known writer. We've been working together since, well, I met her a long time ago, 2005, when she was out at Mullen doing a map of Lake Gregory and so on. Anyway, she's been doing mapping for the company that I work for on facilitating two-way governance. And she thinks I'm shoveling shit uphill in the work that I do. But I think that the work that I do and the process of the way that I do the work with this team is not shoveling shit uphill at all. It's a process of being with people, doing things with people, and that's what works. You know, and if only people could see how simple it is to do that kind of work and work on projects Aboriginal people feel are really, really important to them, then I think we're halfway there. So I'm optimistic in one way, and in another way, it's just taking so long for that simple message to get through to the people that are in places that make decisions about policies to do with, you know, the latest Closing the Gap report. I'm going to download it and read it, but I know what it's going to say. I've read the headlines, and it's saying the same stuff that it said after the first report came out. Non-Aboriginal people have to do things with Aboriginal people. It's simple.
Yeah, it's really simple.
Yes, there's all sorts of people out there in the bush. The other thing that I would say about that is, you know, I mentioned all those lovely professional people that were in the development sector in Papua New Guinea in the days that I was there. It wasn't perfect by any means. and it gave me an opportunity to critique our country's involvement in Papua New Guinea. But in the desert, we've never had a professional place for people to go and train, to go and work with Aboriginal people on their own communities. There's community development practitioners who are probably the best, but all the international development people, they go overseas, and there's status and kudos going to the Pacific or to the African countries or whatever. There doesn't seem to appear to me to be kudos in going to work with Aboriginal people in their communities. And, you know, it's no bed of roses, but you know, I can't understand it, why there isn't that training for doing that kind of work. Everyone goes and learns by experience, and we all make the same mistakes over and over again. There's a book out called Serious Whitefella Stuff by Mark Moran. It's full of all the policy mistakes that we've ever made and they're still making. So that's a good one to look out for. Oh, yeah. There's lots of progress. And look at all the beautiful Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists and writers, and they've got a lot of opportunity now to put forward their own thoughts and feelings. And so that's another really good thing to do, is to read a lot of those, read those things and go to those exhibitions. And we are making some progress. It's very slow.
Today, and on last week's episode of Poetry on the Radio, we've spoken with Canberra-based poet K.A. Kerry Nelson. Next week, our guest will be Martin Dolan. For Artsound FM in Canberra, I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, April 8 at 7 p.m, That Poetry Thing at Smith's Alternative presents the launch of Mary Andrews' Holds Up When Shattered from Kith Books and current work by Sandra Renew. Mary Andrew is a Canberra-based writer and community organisation worker who writes poems and stories about human connections, scenes of strange beauty, the satisfactions and frustrations of work, illness, bodies and yearning. She works as a health promotion officer for Women's Health Matters, a local community organisation. She has previously worked as a researcher at the Australian National University, where she holds a PhD in politics and in organisations focused on ending gender-based violence. She is a member of the organising group for That Poetry Thing. She'll read from her first book, a chapbook, Holds Up When Shattered, published by Kith Books. Sandra Renew's poetry has been awarded 2 Canberra Critics Circle Awards, one in 2023 for Apostles of Anarchy, which recent work Press published, and in 2019 with Moya Pacey, for their influential work in exposing Canberra women's poetry to view through their biannual online journal for women's poetry, Not Very Quiet, 2017 to 2022. Sandra's collection, It's the Sugar Sugar, from Recent Work Press, 2021, won the ACT Writers Notable Awards for Poetry 2021. Acting Like a Girl, Recent Work Press, 2019, was the winner of the 2020 ACT Writing and Publishing Award for Poetry, and was also shortlisted for the 2020 ACT Book of the Year. She writes on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country in Canberra and Yuin land in Cobargo. On April 25, Recent Work Reading presents Lucy Alexander and Adrian Caesar. On April 22, That Poetry Thing presents Linda Godfrey and Samia Goody. On April 29, Mother Tongue and Multilingual Poetry will take to the stage. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly in the studios of Artsound FM in Canberra on unceded traditional land. Hosts Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles create the program with producer Peter Monaghan. Poetry on the Radio is heard each Sunday at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope, performed by the Atrium Musica de Madrid.
Artsound FM, your music and arts companion,